Hello and welcome to The Tally Ho, a podcast all about classic TV show The Prisoner. With me, Bex.
And me, Eason.
First of all, we'd like to give a big thank you to everyone who listened to our recent episode about Arrival. We had some really nice messages from people, and it's really lovely to know that people are listening and enjoying the podcast.
Yeah, and we'd like to not only welcome fans of The Prisoner who've been watching it for a long time, but also people who might be watching it for the first time, having, you know, heard about it or thought, oh, this is a show I might want to get into.
So this is our first bonus episode. As we mentioned at the end of Arrival, we recently had the great pleasure of spending an afternoon with Chris Rodley, the documentary filmmaker behind In My Mind and also the author of Lynch on Lynch, among other books.
And Chris was somebody who we approached because last year, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of The Prisoner, he made a new documentary, which Bex just mentioned, called In My Mind, about him revisiting the interviews with Patrick McGoohan back in 1983, which were originally for a documentary called Six Into One, The Prisoner Files.
There was going to be a rerun of The Prisoner on Channel 4. Channel 4 was a very new network TV channel in the UK at that time. And to accompany the rerun of the series, a documentary was made. And as part of this documentary, Chris Rodley was given the rather unenviable task of trying to get an interview with Patrick McGoohan about The Prisoner. How Patrick McGoohan was very reluctant to talk about what any of it meant. He didn't like explaining things for various reasons that we'll get onto much further on down the line in the podcast. The finale of The Prisoner had caused a bit of a stir when it aired, I think is a mild way of putting it. And so he really didn't like giving interviews about it, but somehow Chris was able to get him to agree to give an interview on camera for this documentary. So he flew out to LA, and the interviews did not really go according to plan, I think is another mild way of putting it. Fast forward all these years later, and in 2017, Chris has had a remarkable documentary filmmaking career. He's also written several books, interview books with directors. And last year he went back to those original interviews with Patrick McGoohan and created a brand new documentary called In My Mind.
In My Mind is a really remarkable film. It chronicles those original interviews, which have now been incorporated into this documentary for the first time. It involves Chris sort of discussing what happened at those interviews, to an extent what went wrong, and actually how much it taught him, I think, about his interactions with Patrick McGoohan and what The Prisoner might actually mean as well. So he came back, he revisited that material. There are brand new interviews with Catherine McGoohan, Patrick McGoohan's daughter, and it's trying to not bring some closure to the whole thing, but to talk a little bit more about what those interviews might have told us about Patrick McGoohan himself and his relationship to The Prisoner and the audience, his work ethic, how he thought about things. And it's a really interesting take on somebody who doesn't really, well, I don't think Patrick McGoohan was known for giving many interviews. Certainly he rarely spoke about The Prisoner in public afterwards. I think there are a few things which are actually shown in this documentary as well. But it's a fantastic look at the original material, which hasn't been seen, and the new documentary. It's really exciting if you're a fan of The Prisoner or just the history of that whole era, I think, of the ITC TV shows and how popular they were, and actually how it also stresses how unique The Prisoner was.
So since the Six Into One documentary in 84, Chris has made dozens of other documentaries, including documentaries on figures such as Donald Cammell, Dirk Bogarde, Johnny Cash. He's made many wonderful music documentaries for the BBC, series like Prog Rock Britannia, Jazz Britannia, and he's also moved from not only producing documentaries, but also he's directed many of these as well.
In this bonus episode, what we've got for you is an interview with Chris, which we had a few weeks back, and it's a first of a two-part episode. It basically discusses In My Mind, Chris's huge interest and love of the TV show, The Prisoner, as well. It talks about his insights into Patrick McGoohan And also it touches upon aspects of his own filmmaking career and his thoughts on the impact that The Prisoner had on the last 50 years of film and television.
And it has to be said that given that one of Chris's other big interests is the work of David Lynch, as is with us too, you might notice that during the conversation we do also occasionally get into a bit of chat about David Lynch and about Twin Peaks. And that conversation really continues in part two of the interview, which is going to go out on our Time for Cherry Pie and Coffee podcast. And on one final note, if you have never seen The Prisoner before and you're watching along with the podcast for the first time and you haven't reached the end yet, you might want to think about leaving this episode until you have reached the end, because we do talk about the finale in our chat with Chris, and there's a couple of things in there that could be a little bit spoilerific. So if you haven't watched to the end yet, maybe come back to this episode a bit later.
But for now, enjoy our chat with Chris.
We're delighted to be joined now by documentary filmmaker and writer Chris Rodley. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, it's lovely for you to join us.
Pleasure.
Now, you're a pretty much a lifelong fan of The Prisoner.
Yes.
And many people who are listening may have watched your In My Mind documentary that's come out recently about your encounter with Patrick McGoohan back in the early 80s, making a different documentary, and also coming back to the documentary again now. How did you first get involved in making the original Channel 4 documentary back in the 80s?
Actually, it's a bit of a sad story in that I worked at the Institute of Contemporary Arts. I ran the cinema there. And I never really got on very well with the director. I never really did what I was told. I mean, I pretend to do it and then I wouldn't do it. Anyway, cut a long story short, I saw the writing on the wall that up ahead was probably the sack. And I was standing on Finsbury Park Underground Station thinking, what can you do? What do you know about? What are you good at? What are you good for? One thing I did know a lot about was The Prisoner, because I'd been, when I first saw it when I was like 15 or whatever, it had never gone away. And then Channel 4 announced that they were going to be showing it. They were going to be reviving it. And I thought, well, I'd written about it actually for a TV magazine called Prime Time and for Time Out. I thought, one thing you do know a lot about is that thing. It's very narrow, but my God, it's coming onto Channel 4. So I had to go to Paris to try and buy a film, distribution rights for a film by Peter Brook on Carmen. He'd made three versions of Carmen, a trilogy. I went to Paris because we distributed movies as well. I didn't get the film. And so I went to a little bar called La Palette, which is just off Rue de Seine in Saint-Germain. I remember it very clearly. And I wrote what I guess is a treatment for a documentary. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I just drank lots of beer. And it was a very cheap, lovely bar, still there, still exactly the same. And I wrote a 5-page thing, which I guess was a kind of treatment, and sent it to Channel 4. And it was kind of crisis management, really, out of desperation, to be honest. I mean, I did want to do it, and I thought, well, okay, just do it. They called me up within 2 days and said, come in. I mean, this is the glory days of early Channel 4, long, God rest their soul. And I went in, and they said, well, we're going to make it, but you don't know anything about television, do you? I said, no, I watch a lot of it, I don't know how to make it. They said, don't worry, we'll stitch you with a director, and we'll stitch you with a producer, and we're going to do it. And so they stitched me with a company and a director. I was supposed to just do the interviewing. I was supposed to write the script and do the interviewing. And so it just was so easy. And so I took a 3-month sabbatical away from the ICA and went and made it, knowing nothing except about the thing, not anything about the filmmaking. After I did the interviewing and all the awfulness with Patrick, which we may or may not talk about, I went back to the ICA. And then I got a call within a week saying, from the director saying, you've got to come back, we don't know what to do with the material. Because I wasn't even supposed to be in the edit, just to generate the material. And so I went back, and luckily, because it was understaffed, I learned a lot of things. Because there was no one else to do it. So they'd say, oh, take this 35mm print from ITC and go and telecine it. And I didn't know what that was. And I said, what's a telecine? And they said, well, you know, you're just going to put it onto... And then I'd go to the telecine, and the guy would say, well, do you want to regrade this? And I'm kind of... It was pink, virtually, this print. It was really bad quality. And suddenly they said, do you want... And I'm learning all this stuff. Like, oh, my God, you can bring life back into that film. You can do this, you can do that. And I used to sneak in at night and do bits of editing even. Not really, really, totally out of my depth. And so it was like that. It was a kind of fluke, because in those days you could do that. Channel 4 were looking for, you know, Channel 4 had a simple remit. No, an impossible remit, but simple. Make innovative television and get 10% of the audience share. Those two things don't go together. They never did. They never will. And so the thing was, we're up for ideas, you know. So literally anyone could write. And if it was a good idea, it might even get made. I don't know if this was a good idea. It's just that they had the series and they thought, oh, great, what we'll do is we'll show it again and we'll show the documentary at the end. And the documentary will explain everything, won't it? and so I was lucky in that respect. In a wider context, I was like a child of Thatcher, really. I mean, it was because that all happened because Margaret Thatcher, you know, didn't all happen because of directly, but the context was she didn't like the BBC. She wanted to weaken their power. She was really behind a new channel being formed. And as much as we hated her and her politics and everything about her, we benefited from that, because suddenly all these people who had never gotten their hands on the filmmaking process got their hands on it. I'd been programming films for 7 years at that time. I mean, I was an independent film exhibition and distribution. I saw lots of things that I thought, oh God, I could do better than that, I'm sure. But I never thought I'd get the chance, because then if you didn't go to the right school. I mean, it was only the BBC. ITV was impenetrable, but the BBC even worse. You didn't have the right education and you weren't of the right whatever. You had no chance of getting in. So it was all sort of a bit like that, a bit sort of chaotic, and no one was minding the store. And that was a sort of, you know, that's how it happened, how lots of things happened. I mean, you know, 69, you know, if you get things like 2001, it's because no one's minding the store. Or if you get Easy Riders, because no one's minding the store. No one's confused and thinking, what, we don't understand what people like anymore. Oh, they like spitting on the American flag and taking drugs and driving around on bikes. They like that now, do they? Let's make that. Because they don't care about anything. They just care about making money. And if you can make them money by whatever you're doing, they'll say, no, you can do that, as long as it's making us money. When it stops making us money, then we'll come for you. But until then, everything's fine. So it was a little chaotic, and I think the film looked like that. But, you know, in those days, you were able to do what you wanted to do, as long as it wasn't like anything else. So I think the film's sort of embarrassing in some respects, but it couldn't have been any other way. We had to make something that way, because that was the alternative way of doing things. You couldn't have a voiceover, you couldn't have presenters, you know, because there was plenty of other things doing that. There was the South Bank show on 26 weeks of the year. It's unbelievable to believe that. I think that could happen now. An arena, an omnibus, and all these things. So as long as it was unusual, you could get away with it. And The Prisoner was perfect, actually, a gift for doing something unusual. You know, you couldn't make a show like we made about Man in a Suitcase. Wouldn't work, or, you know, it just wouldn't work. But because, I mean, I wrote to Patrick. You had to write to people in those days. It wasn't even fax. I wrote to his home, you know, which is odd to think now. And I never kept that letter. I don't know why. I never got a copy. So I don't know why he agreed. It was probably a mistake that he did. But I know one thing I did write in the letters. I promised him that we wouldn't in any way take any of the magic away, and that we weren't looking to answer all the questions. We weren't going to sort of unpick it and analyse it in that boring way. And I think I thought we succeeded in doing that. But maybe in not the way he'd hoped. But I think it was the promise of, we're not going to say this equals that and this means that, was what attracted him to it, the promise of keeping the mystique going.
Did you think that he would actually take part when you first sent this letter, or do you think, well, many people have asked him and, you know, and he just...
I thought he wouldn't, and it wasn't a condition. I said, obviously, we're going to try and get McGowan, but there are lots of other people to talk to. And because I might forget to say it later, I might have to say it, it's not directly related, but you know, it took me a while to realize that intentionality doesn't mean anything. What he thought he was doing, that's his business, you know. And you think you're doing something, and actually you're not. You're doing something else. And also because, and it's important with David Lynch, actually, is that you, once you've made something and you release it into the world, you have no control over that thing. And it's very important for Lynch, and it's very important for Patrick. I think Patrick had, you know, he had no control over what was going to happen. I think he found some of the fandom stuff frightening, a bit frightening. But I think that's just proof that what he'd done was really good. But he hadn't, you know, he was puzzled by the anger, literally, of after Fallout, the kind of, you know, all the stuff that happened. But because he had genuinely overestimated his audience, you know, and he'd angered them. And I think he pretended he sort of quite liked that anger. And I think he liked debate and he liked to fight. But I think he underestimated the power of his own work, so he underestimated the response. Mm. What he thought about it, of course I wanted to know. You want to know, David Lynch, tell me really what that means. Or Patrick, tell me what that really means. But you have to get over that, really. I got over it a long time ago. It doesn't stop you wanting to know. Mm. But what they intended and what came out, you know, it's up to us to decide what that means. That's another role. And often what people think they've done isn't what they've done. And sometimes the answers are really banal, actually. And you think, well, that's not very interesting. I mean, I've heard critics say more interesting things about that. Or just someone who you might think is just a mad fan has a more interesting take on that than you do. And I think maybe, you know, I don't think Patrick really wanted to say what it was about. And he might not have even known. I think he did know, actually, but I think there was stuff he couldn't talk about. I think it was all very, it was rooted in a very tortured kind of personality and a lot of Roman Catholicism and a lot of strange stuff, probably.
Given the lag between the end of the series and when you approached him about making this documentary, do you think that he felt that maybe it might have been now the time when he could start talking about it?
I think he wanted to. You know, it's funny, in the documentary, you know, I hadn't seen that thing he'd done for Canadian television, but he talked quite openly, actually. But I think he knew that was in Canada and no one would ever see it, as we didn't until YouTube emerged, finally. But anyway, he was rather flattered, probably, that the audience were people who were studying the university in Canada, something that angered George Markstein like crazy. I mean, I remember George Markstein saying to me, can you fucking believe it? You know, they're studying it at university. How ridiculous. Well, it is ridiculous if you're basically a spy man. It's not ridiculous if you're kind of, you know, if you have more philosophical kind of concerns. But I think he spoke in Canada because he thought no one would hear it. I think, you know, he did want to have some kind of come to terms with his British audience, because, you know, he did have this messianic complex about that they, if he ever came back to Britain, they would crucify him. A well-chosen word, not a mistake. So I think he wanted to come clean. I think he did, actually. That's not necessarily a very interesting thing. I mean, when I did the 2 one-hour films with Dirk Bogart, you know, just a few years before he died, Dirk was the same. I think he wanted to. He'd been so horrible to so many people, genius that he is. I think he just wanted to come clean. He just wanted to clear the slate. I think he probably thought he didn't have very long, which he didn't, as it turns out. And he never went on camera again after that. So, but that sort of coming to, you know, that's not necessarily that going to produce any interesting material necessarily. But I think he did want to talk. And I think when he saw what we'd made, he realised that had been a mistake. And I think after that, he didn't really want to talk. He rarely did after that. I think we probably contributed to a lot of people getting turned down. It's unfortunate. We did let him down in a peculiar way. We didn't mean to. I didn't mean to. But it's easy to let someone down who's got such high expectations of everybody, not least of all themselves.
How did it feel when you were shooting that original interview in the empty house? Because it's really odd to watch the footage now. There's a strangeness of being around, you know, bare shelves and empty cupboards. It's almost like a kind of trick house, like a village house.
I know, yeah, I know. It's weird. I didn't, you know, I was so nervous and I was so, I was a mixture, I was so excited and really frightened. when he said, oh, I have a friend, you know, I have a friend, he's away on holidays and we can film in his house. I just accepted that. I just thought, well, that's great. Obviously, that when you look at it, even when we were there, I didn't realise it. That's not true at all. I mean, that, I think Joan, lovely Joan, who had never met his wife, was in real estate, and I think she had the keys to a house that was being sold. I mean, so that right there was weird, because there was nothing. It was weird. It's all beige, and there's nothing in it really. So, so that was the neutral ground. So it was odd anyway that we had to kind of meet in this place, which seemed very strange. I was really, really nervous, and it was clear that the American crew that we'd hired weren't really. I mean, you can see from the footage, you know, they didn't really know what they were doing. I didn't know then. I didn't know. I knew nothing. So when I look at it now and I see shadows falling, boom shadows, and they can't even light a shot, you know. So that's shocking. I didn't choose the crew. It wasn't my job. I was just doing the interview. I was the sort of lackey. So they couldn't technically do it very well. They couldn't record very well. My director, who I kept, was, you know, from here, and we went together, abdicated virtually within 15 minutes. I mean, when he realised that Pat was going to run the show, he just abdicated. And he just let Patrick do whatever he wanted. And so that was a bit shocking for me, because I thought, well, I'm not the director. What do I do here? I'm just there. I'm going to sit there and ask the questions. I've got a director who seems to have just abandoned any hope of doing anything. I've got a crew who are losing their mind, because Patrick would say, well, okay, now we're going to move the camera here. And then we're going to do a pickup shot, and I'm just going to walk. And the cameraman is thinking, no, we're just doing a sit-down interview. I mean, we're not orchestrating a kind of drama. But Patrick kept wanting to change the camera angle and do this, and we'll just do a little link here and that. So I just saw it all coming down around my ears, around me. And actually, as I thought, this might be my new career. I just thought, well, that's not going to be my new career. I'm going to go back, get the sack, and that will be it. This is not going to pan out, because I was, you know, sometimes you just need to think, well, even if I know nothing, I know better than these people. I should have looked through the viewfinder and gone, that's rubbish, guys, or said to the director, you know, there is a way of dealing with this, instead of being so timid. I was very timid. And I mean, I produced documents for 9 years before I even directed, because I didn't feel I was, you know, that's just an approach to life, you know, to do it when you think you're good enough and ready. And I certainly didn't then, and it just sort of, so it was awful. And when he wanted to buy all the footage back, it was awful that we couldn't do that. When he said, let's do it all again, I was hugely relieved, actually. But then that got screwed as well, because we went up onto the hill where he wanted to go, and then there's a setting sun behind him, and he becomes a silhouette because no one's brought any lights with him. So although I think he was quite generous at that point and quite relaxed, and there's one little moment when he's really off guard, which you dream of, hope for, he's sort of, you know, you can barely see him. So that's annoying. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think when he talks about Once Upon a Time and he pretends he doesn't know what's going on, it's a great little moment for me. I don't even remember him saying that. It wasn't until we looked at it again to do the new documentary that when he says, I got it out, whatever you got. I think there's probably a name for it. I don't know what it is, but I got it out. And, well, yeah, we know what you're talking about. And that's the closest you're going to get, I think, the closest anyone ever got, were him copying to the whole idea of kind of psychoanalysis and primal screen therapy and all that stuff he knew about. Of course he knew about it all. That's what he did. I mean, he destroyed Leo McKern and he had to put himself back together again. That was a relief. But even so, I have to say, that kind of relaxed interview isn't, you know, mostly as revealing as the terrible one. So, you know, I hadn't seen the footage for 35 years. So, you know, as I said at L Street, you know, I didn't think we could make anything from it. I didn't want to look at it. I didn't want to do it, actually. It was painful. I think because I sort of loved him in a way. I didn't want to. It was embarrassing. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to even say that. But I didn't want to look at that footage. And when I did, it was as bad as I thought it was. And it brought back horrible memories. And when you let someone down like that, I mean, that's... No, you don't. I don't know. But, you know, your first girlfriend, boyfriend... You know, it is a bit like that. You think, God, I didn't deal with that very well. Mm. Or I wasn't a good enough fucker. I mean, whatever it might be, you know, I didn't have enough experience or confidence or knowledge. And if only we'd met at another time in life, you know. That's how I sort of felt. He was my first Patrick. You know, and I noticed one of the questions you just asked, well, one thing you said we might talk about is that, so what effect does that have on you? He made every film I made after that much better. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know it. He never knew that. Because he was quite horrid to me, as he was to everybody. But, you know, sometimes people have to, you know, I'd rather someone shout at me and tell me what I'm doing wrong than sort of pretend I'm doing it fine. And he, you know, gave me some, you know, at one point I was reading my questions, he just exploded, you know, just said, I don't want to, when I'm talking, I want to look at you. I want to, don't look at me, don't look down at questions. That's not, I need someone to look at. Don't ever do that. And I've never, ever done that. 34 years after since that, I've never, ever. I write questions out, I either memorize them or I try and find moments where I can do a quick glance down, or I don't even look at them. I just don't look at them. Because he's right. You don't, you know. If you've ever had to do an interview by remote control, I've had to do a few, where I've sent questions to someone who's in a part of Australia to do an interview for. It's when they come back, it's just terrible. Because you can hear them. So next, you know, and you can hear, you think, how rude. You can tell. The person being interviewed is thinking, what's this? What are you doing? You know. Oh, and they don't, people say mad things. So instead of picking them up on that mad thing they said, they just go to the next question. You know, oh, and by the way, I killed my wife. Oh, yeah, okay. So next, you know, that's not how you do it. You've got to look them right in the eye. That's what that was. He said, do that. And I've never not done that ever since. Unless, you know, I remember the first of three times I interviewed Lemmy. I mean, it was quite clear. Whatever you'd written down meant nothing anyway. And my sound guy often says, I saw you just chuck the questions on the floor. I'm like, well, Chris, well, you're grey hair, I can't do that. You know, it's sort of, why don't you die here? So he was my first. Everyone else benefited from him being my first. And then, you know. It didn't prepare me for some other people I don't back up, but it, you know, it's I owe a lot to him for that. In effect, actually, it's a shame. You know, he was just with an inexperienced person who couldn't do the job properly.
Do you think that when he saw that things might be about to unravel or easy to exploit, do you think it was in his nature to want to take control and see whether he could exploit that?
Totally. I think he was trying to help me. He was trying to make a better thing. Mm. Yeah, we're all after the same thing, to make the best film possible. Mm. So when he saw weaknesses, you know, you have to move in. I mean, I think he did it on The Prisoner, you know, when he saw, you know, people go on about that, you know, directors getting sacked. Well, sack them. If they were like mine, sack them. Mm. Tough. If you could see if it's not happening right, we've got to make sure this happens right. It might be inappropriate. It certainly was inappropriate in those days for the actor. You know, I don't think Roger Moore, actually Roger did direct a few episodes of The Saint, but I don't know how he did that or what that really means. But, you know, because it was seen as inappropriate, I think. And also because he had ambitions for television. I mean, it's bigger things here. You know, it's not for Orson Welles to say as late as 1969, McGoohan would have been, you know, one of Britain's best actors if he hadn't been grabbed by television. It's so dumb as a comment. I mean, because in those days, I guess no one had, it's all ephemeral, right? It's telly. Oh, look, we got Pink Floyd on Top of the Pops. Let's wipe that tape. Let's wipe that. Let's get and throw the Who and Register Any Who away. Let's throw that away. Let's destroy every episode of Not Only But Also. I suppose no one really thought about television as a serious thing. I think he did. Mm. I think he was a prophet in that way. I mean, he was. But television, not like Jonathan Miller deigning to do a version of Alice in Wonderland for the BBC. It's not like that. It was like really ITC, ITV, Lou Grid, entertaining television with ambitions. I can't think anyone's ever done that, actually, since. That's why it's such an important thing. You know, he under the guise of John Drake and all that kind of stuff, which I think he sort of enjoyed in a way. He denied it all, but, you know, why did he use the publicity shot for Danger Man as his shot in The Prisoner? Why? That's just mischievous. Mm. So he knows what he's doing. He can slide in. And he's got all that baggage, lovely, and we can do something that's really not that. And we've got a guy who's stupid enough to give us the money, who loves us so much he'll give us the money. But, you know, he understood the importance of television. But that was his, you know, his destiny, his palette, you know. That's what's so great about it, I think. It's someone who very early on saw how important it was. And now, God, he'd be laughing now, right? All these awful movies, two-dimensional, boring movies, and all this great television, with every decent actor of any worth wanting to do television. You know, why would you want to do movies? You know, when you can do something like... I mean, I've just been watching something on Netflix called Godless. I mean, it's gobsmacking. It's gobsmacking. I mean, Jeff Daniels, Jesus Christ. When did he ever get his teeth? You know, it's just so great now. That, or, and I think he knew that. He knew how, you know, it would be. And so for that, that's, I think that's why... Lots. That's why I couldn't get it out of my mind.
Do you think he actually also anticipated the idea of using television to do slightly long form but fixed length stories as well? Because he does talk about the idea of it being 7 episodes and having to go up. But it wasn't like an ongoing, let's do series after series after series. That you could use.
It's like True Detective. And it's like, this is the, you know, they're going to be, he says 7. I don't know if anyone really knows. I think he does say 7. So there must have been, I suspect actually 3 of those 7 aren't very good. I mean, not for me, because they're the sort of tub thumping soapbox ones like Checkmate and things like that. I mean, I think the ones, Once Upon a Time is the all time great episode, but I prefer some of the others, which he might have regarded as fillers, you know, because I think they really are more revealing. That number 6, whoever it is a masochist. He can get out. Of course he can get out. He doesn't want to get out. I mean, that's what's interesting about it. It's called The Prisoner. It's all about trying to escape. But of course it's not about, he doesn't want to get out. Actually, he's no interest in getting out. He can get out. It doesn't make any sense really. If he really does want to get out. He doesn't want to get out. He's absolutely a masochist. He's absolutely he's in purgatory, you know, his own purgatory. And really the best episodes are the ones where that's clear and where it's about negotiate, you know, it's about beating the man. That's what I mean. I think Hammer into Anvil is a fantastic piece of work, you know, great piece of casting. Patrick Cargill, who's a kind of comedy actor, and Brian Rixbarth's and lots of stupid stuff, is a really horrid, I mean, truly psychotic person, evil person who he beats. It's about beating, you know, it's about beating them at their own game. That's what's so great about it. That's what's so satisfying about that. And that doesn't make that depressing. I mean, the Americans might have found that depressing if they saw it when they saw it. That he never gets out the door, you know. But that's not, because that's not really it. It's about beating them, isn't it? It's like being, you know, it's about winning a case in a courtroom or something. Those are the best ones, I think, to me.
So do you think also that that's part of the reason why it's stood the test of time as a TV show? It's out of any particular time, and yet its themes, you know, resonate even today.
Yes, totally. I mean, I can't think of another time when, you know, in the film, when Blue Griefer says, you know, he's this guy who just, you know, just saying, you know, something's going on and I want to know what it is, you know, what's going on. I mean, if you wake up one morning and you've decided you're coming out of Europe, or you don't, someone's decided you're coming out of Europe, or you wake up one morning and Donald Trump is president, all those things, if there ever was a time to think, what's going on? Something's going on. What is it? What's going on? That kind of what the hell is going on under the surface is never, I mean, it gets worse, that, I think. So ideas about surveillance, when you think about now, you know, all the things that he found so repugnant and frightening have become true and more. I mean, you know, I had to put up with a long tirade from him on Santa Monica Beach about, I think that was the year that Americans were, it was, you had to wear a seatbelt. And he wasn't having it. You know. He said, I want to kill myself, I'm not having it. I think it's outrageous. You know, he said, it was just seatbelts, you know, and the veins are standing up on the side of his neck. And all about a seatbelt. And I didn't drive then, actually, so it matters to me. But he was outraged, being told, you will wear a seatbelt, you will be safe. So from something as simple as that, but if now, you know, if he was now, and people are emailing him saying, you were interested in this, we think you might be interested in that. He would have been, I mean, that thing where you have no privacy, you have none, where this country has got more surveillance cameras in it than virtually the whole rest of the world, where, you know, you can't get away with anything, where your personal life is not yours anymore. I mean, all that. I mean, I don't think it's any more complicated than that. And it looked a bit paranoid and weird then. And it was expressed in rather silly ways with kind of papier-mâché statues twisting around. You know, it's clunky. But it's this, it is that thing. It's so... Everyone must feel that now. I mean, it must look rather quaint now. You know, it's not about cordless telephones, so what? You know, it was in Thunderbirds. I mean, it's kind of like... it's those predictions are rather... But not everyone would... It's just things that you would like to do, you know, like Skype or something. Basically, you know, you'd like to have someone come up on the screen and talk to you. Oh, that's lovely, isn't it? That'd be lovely. But that's just your artist's imagination, thinking what would be nice that we don't have. But those real underlying things about your, you know, not having your own life for some reason. Is, I mean, I think when I saw it, I'm just being on a very personal thing. I'd just been, you know, ripped out of my home in London and dropped down in Stevenage, Newtown, just the year before. And I think, even on that level, you know, I was wandering around this horrible place, Newtowns in those days, you know, 2 million acres of grassland. They don't tell you it's all in like 2-inch strips around cycle paths like that. In a horrible place with no friends, thinking, what am I doing here? And I think that sort of, you know, when I watched the series, it spoke, even on that level, it spoke to me, like just waking up in a sort of a supposedly ideal place, you know, don't live in grimy London, live in a lovely Newtown. It was sort of similar in a way, and I thought, God, this is like the village. It's just why I'm liking it, because I'm alone here in this place, and I don't belong here. Where's my, you know, I woke up here one morning, don't like it.
So it added tremendous resonance to, you know, every episode starting with him seeing the world, and it's it's unfamiliar.
I know.
And how did it happen overnight?
I know, but you know, it's a kind of... Well, you know, you might think it was a kind of drug experience if you were old enough, or it would at that time. But it's also a bit like, you know, that poor Marion, there isn't... I was completely obsessed with Last Tango in Paris, for all... not for the obvious reasons. But and I went to Paris and I sought out those locations. And, you know, I pissed where Marlon Brando pissed, in that cafe. And the guy serving the coffees was the guy in the film, because they just used to be in the film. I found the apartment. I went, you know, I found out a lot about filmmaking that way. When I found the apartment, I realised that they went in door number one, but the lift was in number four, and the actual apartment was in number six in these buildings. So I, you know, in being an obsessive about that film, I kind of worked out how filmmaking was done, actually, piecing together. That's only to say that the thing about The Prisoner is, Port Merritt, it's just that one place, you know, it's just that one place. I mean, Twin Peaks is North Bend and Snoqualmie. It's a few places, and even more later on. But there's nothing I can think of that's like, well, it's just that one place. You can actually just go to that one place and get the experience. There's no, barely, you know. I mean, there are a few London locations, but you get the experience in that one place. There's not anywhere like that. Even though the telly's littered with kind of shows that are called the name of the place, you know, I don't, whatever it is, whether it's Dallas or, you know, there's like an obsession with place names. I guess we have them too, Coronation Street, maybe. I don't know, it doesn't quite work for me, but you can get the prison experience from that one place, and that it's impossible to think of it without that place, and vice versa. It's just that was, you know, one of those unbelievably fortuitous things. It's a lot of the experience, that place. Even now, you just can't not feel that, you know, can't. It's weird. Strange.
So what triggered you, well, aside maybe the 50th anniversary, for you to return to that original footage and come up with the idea of In My Mind?
Well, it was literally, I just got called up by Network, who had acquired all, you know, they were heading up to the 50th anniversary. They'd acquired from Illuminations, the original production company, all the footage. And they just said, do you think there's another, you know, could you reimagine it for the 50th anniversary? Because we want to do something that's either exclusively or primarily from Patrick's point of view. And, you know, I lied and said, yes, I think we can do that. They sent me the footage. I didn't look at it for a few days. I did. They said, what do you think? And I said, yes, we can. I still didn't believe it. So I wrote a kind of treatment. So I did it. Actually, I did it because I thought I owed it to Patrick to try, have another shot. Because if you get a chance to redo something, like do a relationship you screwed up or whatever, do it, you know, take try and make it better. So I did it, but I didn't think it was really possible, but I just went along hoping it would be possible. And even when we were in Port Merryn doing the drone shots, you know, I still didn't quite I didn't know how this was all going to fit together. All I know is I thought, let's do that, because no one's seen Port Merryn like that. We've got unique access. Patrick just had all these clunky 35mm shots from a helicopter. Just imagine what he could do with a drone. I mean, that would have been such a godsend to him, especially about something that's about surveillance and never having, you know, having some snooping on you all the time. Let's at least do that. But it was part of a kind of long-term bluff, really. I mean, I know maybe network don't even believe me, but it's true. You have to do a lot of bluffing sometimes, and I still didn't quite know what was going to happen. So I just pieced all the bits together, Catherine, and then, so we got all the stuff together, and we went into the editing room. We had 8 weeks to edit, and on the first day I didn't know what was going to happen. I just didn't, and it's frightening. It's exciting, but it's frightening, because you can't tell anyone that, because they'll just go, what are you talking about? We're paying you money to do this. I mean, it's not, what do you mean you don't know what you're going to do? But then... During the first week of the edit, I got up one morning and it sometimes happens that way, thank God. I just suddenly thought, and I thought how we were going to do the Huntley Hotel sequence, that first meeting with Patrick. And once I got that, then we were off. You know, it was just, how are we going to do it? There's no outtakes of all the awful things that happened. How are we going to talk about them? What are we going to be looking at? So, and suddenly that was clear how we might do that. But I don't know if that's lucky, but it happened that way. And again, it's a bit of an overlap, because I remember David Lynch saying to me that when he'd just done a Razorhead and some shorts, and he came over to do Elephant Man, and there were all these horrible kind of English actors giving him a hard time. Who are you, a young sort of American cult director? I don't know who you are. How he was terrified, because he didn't know what he was going to do. And of course he describes it always the same way, like a wind or something, but you know, how he was at the Whitechapel Hospital or something, and this wind, whatever. Anyway. But I know kind of what he means. He means he suddenly thought, he got the first signs that he could make a film out of this. But that was way down the line, you know, after he'd committed to doing it and casting. So sometimes it's not clear. Actually, that's not a bad way to work. I mean, I know lots of directors and I despise the way they work, because they write it all down, this is what's going to happen. And they have kind of spreadsheets, even. I've seen these director's spreadsheets, amazing things, where they just say, we're going to talk to corporal, whatever it is, and he's going to say that. And then we're going to talk to her, and she's going to say that. And it's all sort of mapped out, and I'm thinking, well, I don't know why you bother doing it, really. That's not, you've got it on paper, do a book. Films are a bit more organic than that. So that was very organic, because I didn't really think it could be done, and we did it. And no one was more relieved than me, actually.
What was your initial feeling actually watching some of the original footage?
It was painful, because I had nothing but bad memories. When I started thinking about it, I remember lots of nice things about it. Lovely chats with Patrick and some fun. But I hadn't thought about it for so long, and when I did, I only could remember bad things. So when I saw the footage, it sat there on my computer for days. You know, I couldn't look at it. It was as bad as I thought it was, as I remembered it. It mostly was exactly as I remembered it. So it was a way of looking at that and thinking, well, without stitching him up, because of course you can't do that, you would never do that, how can we make the painfulness of that how can we not make him look foolish? So it's more to do with the tone, actually. We must be honest about this, that it was sort of our fault. He didn't help, but, you know, it was our fault, and we bit off more than we could chew, and we underestimated the magnitude of the task. We were sort of, not complacent, but we really underestimated what we were up against. So it was just being clear that... I mean, I went about it as if he was still alive, and that I was going to have to show him that as well. Luckily, he isn't. But so that it had to be. It was a way of judging the tone, I think, and pointing the finger where it really needed to be pointed, which was sometimes at him, but it was mostly at us, actually.
So you also mentioned just now the drone footage that you featured at Port Merryn. It's wonderful. It makes Port Merryn look beautiful. So. When did you actually do that? How long did it take? What was it all?
We went in June. I got a drone crew. I have a friend who works in feature films, and she just done worked with this crew on a David Hare movie. And she said, these guys are good. And so she's a good friend. I trusted her. We met them on that morning or the night before. Two amazing guys. If they'd have been younger, they'd have been sperm. I mean, one's about 23. I don't know. I mean, they didn't know the prisoner. They'd never been to Port Mooney. Nothing about it. Mm. Which was good because they weren't sort of contaminated by that. But they were amazed by it, of course. So, and we had kind of absolute, we'd been given total access, which is actually quite hard to get, and it may be impossible, only because of the 50th and because of network. And because of legalities with drones, because you have to have a pilot's license and everything, can't be closer than 30 metres to a person. Anyway, there are distances. Mm. So they said, you got from 7 in the morning till 10. At 10 o'clock, the tourists come in, the day people. So you have 3 hours. So we had 3 hours. That was enough, though, actually. We shot like crazy. Two residents complained. I think the people at Port Mooney Hotel were very, you know, very nice. They were sort of on our side. But, you know, people look at their windows and they think you see a camera flying by. I suppose it's understandable. I don't know. I don't think so, actually. But so we had the 3 hours just to do it. But we met the night before, and I took the guys around the village and said, these are the important things. We need these particular buildings mean something, and these locations mean something. And, you know, we've got, you know, and you have ideas about, you know, coming out. What's so amazing about it is that now with a drone, it looks like God's crane. I mean, it's so steady. You can be up in the clouds and you can tilt down. I mean, things that would have been impossible, absolutely impossible. You think, how is that possible? And then so you can really see how weird it is, the way it sticks out on in Traumatic Bay like that. It's really very strange. So I just wanted it to look, it was a very simple idea. How can we film it in a way that's like you just sort of gasp? Because that might be how it looks, it might have been how it looked to him when he first went. You know, like, my God. You know, I mean, and just that wonder. Mm. Actually, you do get, anyone get, you get there and you think, my God, look at this. And because your brain does all this work and your eyes, a drone only really just is quite sometimes just a good way of, although it looks kind of high tech, it actually sort of just is like you sort of perceive things, actually. You sort of are all over it, aren't you? With, you know, it's not sort of static shot.
I do wonder if the prison was being made now, it does feel like drones would have been used very heavily.
Oh, I know. I didn't see the ream. I didn't see that awful thing that they made. I never saw that. I couldn't face that. I mean, on the whole, I think just leave it alone. You know, don't mess with it. I mean, every time something came up, I would be horrified. You know, oh, my God. Well, because he did Braveheart, and he was so brilliant, and that Mel Gibson was thinking of doing a remake of it. And you're thinking, oh, God, no. Let's that not happen. Every time there's talk of Ridley Scott still doing it, I think, you know, leave it alone. Just leave it alone. I don't, you know, it seems a silly thing to play around with. You'd have to do what David Lynch did with, you know, Return. You've got to really rethink the whole thing, in which case it won't be anything like that. Mm. I mean, I had for a while there, I had a little kind of scheme of my own, because I was looking at Catherine in Port Mooney, and I thought, I know what I'd like to do. I'd like her to wake up there one morning. I mean, it would be, and we'd do something about a kind of almost like a DNA inheritance prisoner. It would just be, you know, we wouldn't even have to reference it very much. You just have to know who it is and where they are, and then you can weave something else. But it has all this sort of baggage. I still might do that, but someone else is going to do it now. But, she might not want to do that, but I just could quite like to see. I'd like to wake up there one morning looking more mystified, like, what am I doing here? But just rethink it. And of course, it doesn't have to be a bloke. I mean, why is it always, you know, it's banal too often. I mean, I don't mean some dumbass thing like Ghostbusters, let's make him three women, a kind of knee-jerk thing, but just something meaningful, like his daughter. Yeah. Maybe it was just maybe she inherited something else, you know. Some weird way, who knows? Just rethink it.
So you think it was actually important that, you know, an aspect of it was how innovative it was, rather than actually what was going on. It was the fact it was a new thing. So actually, if you were to revisit the idea in some way, the only way to really make it successful would be to make it just as bold and original.
Yes,
as the original,
exactly. You know? Just rethink it, yeah. You know. And so, in as much as this does connect to Twin Peaks seriously, actually, you know, if when Twin Peaks hit, that was like a big bang moment for television, mm. or however you know. So it's a serious big bang moment. So, and we now all live, or we have for years been living in the universe that was created by that big bang moment. So you don't often get a second, you know, what happens if you're going to make another big bang moment? You created the landscape that you're living in, and now you've got to do it, you've got to do something else. So you've got to have another kind of evolutionary moment. You know, you could come up with something else because you've created that the universe, and the universe has moved on. In some respects, it's gotten better than you could ever imagine. So you can't. It's not a matter of. That's the new landscape, and the new landscape is a much more interesting place than before. You know, so now you've got to top that. Although I don't think Lynch thought in that way. You know, he's living 25 years later. So I think, luckily, all he has to do is he's the same guy, but he's 25 years older, and he'll just keep doing that. So he doesn't have to think, what do I do? What's happened? You know, he just has to do what he does 25 years later. That's the sort of trick, I think. It's not a trick, actually. It's just what he did. And because I think he's about Big Bang, you know, he's about that, you know, he does that naturally. Mm. And I think Patrick does that naturally. Did that naturally. He just never got much opportunity to do it after that. I don't think American, you know, it's all right, okay, you've got a few Emmys, I mean, doing Columbo, and he was a good pal to Peter Falk. And there's a few things, but it doesn't add up to anything, really. Not much. So he never got the chance because he's so difficult to work with, probably. It's part of it, you know, probably part of it. Who's going to take him on? Mm. I mean, what script, if he didn't write the script, no script, you know, he's just going to be going through, you know, not doing that. We can't do that, can we do that? You know, he's too good a director and too good a writer. He's too good at too many things to put up with it. And I don't know how Stanley Kubrick got away with it for years, but he did. Some, I guess, they decided they'd leave him alone. And he got away with things no one would ever get away with. Mm. But he does know more about cameras than any cameraman. I mean, he could do it. He could tell Lucien Ballard, I don't want the 8mm, take that off, put the other one on. I mean, he knew. And I think Patrick was too good at too many things to suffer fools, you know. So you've got to find a backer. Mm. And Lynch has benefited from having, you know, backing, you know, for a while from France, but from Europe, basically. There's no American, you know. So he gets nice people in Europe to back him. And then that's another discussion. But, you know, you've got to find people. And I don't know who at Showtime thought that was a good idea. I'm really glad. David Nevins must be mad. And I think they're even talking about doing another one. Anyway, that's something. But, you know, I think they knew, jumping ahead a bit, they knew that it didn't really matter if viewing figures weren't, which they weren't. They knew that actually there's going to be a lot of people signing up for that streaming service. Yeah. There's going to be a massive sign-up. So that's a good thing right there. And they're going to get all the brownie points they could ever hope for. And they can look great. They can look great. Like Mel Brooks, you know. He looks great. Mel Brooks, you know, I've never been a fan of Mel Brooks. Except he financed David Cronenberg's The Fly and he did Elephant Man. Yeah. How bad can he be? And Stuart Kornfeld, I think, produced both of those. Who worked with him. So that's enough for me. It's like if you're Van Morrison, you're Astral Weeks. It doesn't matter what you do after that. You've done Astral Weeks. Great. I mean, we'd all love to do something half as good as that. You don't have to do anything else. Retire.
So we talked a bit about how the public had a very strong reaction to Fallout, if you can put it that way.
Yeah, sure.
A slightly negative reaction to Fallout. Do you think that McGoohan would have gone on to do something different had the public reaction not been so negative?
I think he was. Obviously, he was surprised by the kind of intensity of the reaction. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he would have done next anyway. I think he would have had to take a long break. I mean, I think he must have been totally wrung out by the time that was over. And I think he did want to, I mean, as far as I understand it, he did want to do a film version of Brand. He did want to do this thing about sort of the IRA or Ireland or gangsters in Ireland. So I think he did know what he wanted to do next. Both of them film things, actually, not television. So I don't know. It's hard to imagine. It's like, you know, I saw Jimi Hendrix 5 times. I'm that old. No one goes on about, you know, oh, what would Jimi have done? You know, I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. I think if they'd have left him alone, if the Black Panthers had left him alone, if everyone had just left him alone, my guess is he would have become an exquisite jazz guitarist. That's mm-hmm. my guess. But I don't know. I don't know what Patrick would have done if he'd been given a free... He was never going to... It would have to be very particular for him. He'd have to have someone like Lou Grade or Lou Grade himself again to allow him that space. And who knows what that would have been. I think that was his statement. I think that was his statement. And it was a statement. It's a kind of evangelical thing. So maybe... I mean, it's true that if, you know, you could write a book about British cinema without mentioning him, a book about British theatre probably without mentioning him, but you couldn't write a book about British television without mentioning him, without having his own chapter. So to me, I think, you know, for me, he's not a movie guy. And he's done a few movies, and they're quite good, All Night Long, it's really intense, but I don't know what he would have done in television, because I think that's what he should have been doing. I think it's natural to want to go to Hollywood and do that really boring movie, Ice Station Zebra. God, is that boring? And create problems for the prisoner because you're not there, so you have to come up with a narrative where you put your brain in someone else. But I think it would have been telly, but I think that was his big thing. Maybe he would never have done anything else, and that would have been fine. That's enough. It's enough. I mean, there was so many talk. There was even talk at one time, it's so much urban myth around these kind of things, about that he was considering doing a series with Alexis Cannon and Angelo Muscat, just a thing with just, you know, the kid and the butler on their adventures around the world or something. I mean, that could have been all right. I think it's a problem, isn't it? Because if you're writing the rules for television, what then do you, what do you do next? I mean, he did read, and the weird thing is nothing. It didn't really affect anything after it. For a long time. Mm. I mean, I suddenly thought, as a naive kind of fifth former or whatever, oh, there'll be lots of interesting things now. And I thought, I'm going to see the next thing that ITC does. But it was like back to one. I mean, apart from The Champions, which was a bit sort of weird, and Randall and Hopcote deceased because one of them was dead, it was a bit weird. But they weren't weird. They weren't really interesting weird like The Prisoner. They were just sort of slightly odd.
They had this sort of weird conceit, but not actually weird in execution,
but not in the thing, no, in the thing itself. And so it didn't impact, it didn't seem to me. It took years, and actually it maybe was the kids who saw that stuff who then got into television who really cemented that influence. And you know, it was not anything for a while, but all those people who'd been influenced by that then, you know, took that on board. And that's the same with Twin Peaks, a lot of things, you know. So I really don't know what I would have done. I wasn't satisfied by anything after that, really. I wasn't satisfied by Columbo. I mean, I was so happy when I saw him working, but nothing ever really did it. I mean, I suppose because he is essentially Brand, so that's him. And then, you know, then it's sort of, and everything emanates from that one thing. I don't know how much of that kind of well-armed kind of guy who just won't put up with anything you could put up with. I don't really know. Would have been nice to think. I'm not sure what his range was. What he might have done. I mean, if I was a director, I'd kill to get hold of him as raw material, you know. And I'd kill to actually commission him to write something. He's such a great writer. He's so clever. I think the one thing he was out of whack with, it's really important to The Prisoner, is all that kind of nursery rhyme, fairy tale, Alice in Wonderland, you know, that lovely kind of fairy tale dimension to it all, which is totally original, I think. I mean, now, you know, how much Ken Loach and, you know, how much of this stuff can you bear? Miserable people sitting around cloths, just in horrible gingham tablecloths, discussing about illegal abortions because it's 1950s. I mean, you know, I just can't bear it. It's so tedious. It's all right, but it's all like that. And now good British television is really grim, and it's all really real. And you know, I don't know, maybe there's a little flight of fancy like Hard Sun, but they didn't know how to deal with it because they're in a real world, so they can't deal with it. I think what McGoohan understood, and actually was the same with Lynch, is that sometimes the things you have to say don't fit well into conventional narrative storytelling. They just don't. They won't. You can't tell them the way you want to tell them.
Do you think he understood the impact of the prisoner, or did that never really matter to him when he was...
I think he was... it was hard to tell, because he said to me that he found some of the kind of worship of it and the fandom surrounding it frightening. I think that because he thought that was invasive, because those kinds of people, whoever he thought they were, I don't think he was very kind, actually, in some cases about that, would want to know about his private... It was never enough. You know, he'd have to kind of, you know, be eviscerated to kind of... So he's a bit frightened by it, a bit puzzled by it. But when it was, you know, but he was also, of course it pleased, of course it did. You can hear it in his voice, actually. He loved it, that there were warring factions, you know. People trying to kind of claim, which you know is very true, trying to claim ownership of it. And, you know, I think he's, why wouldn't you like it? I think he's, as ever, sort of ambivalent about it. Because it was proof that he'd found something, you know, he'd done something really right. I think what he did really right was a really, really simple idea. Someone trying to get out of somewhere, maybe, and not succeeding. And a kind of peculiarly brilliant combination of kind of production design and location and a simple idea. It's just so, you know, it was just so perfect, that kind of very simple thing. And because it was so... like the best sci-fi, it was all like a metaphor, and you sort of knew it, really. I mean, I think you thought you didn't know it. I mean, when I think now, why were we surprised by the ending? I mean, the first show, 30 minutes in, a big balloon comes and squashes it, and why did we ever think, or based on that, that we were ever going to, you know, there's a clue there, this is not going to work out, this is not the normal thing. You know, there's a clue. So, I don't know what we expected. And I think that kind of metaphor, you know, there's that lovely, any good sci-fi, you know, it's not about the future, it's not about spaceships, it's about now, you know, as we know, it's all metaphor, it's like J.G. Ballard, it's about now, that's what's interesting about it. There's that great, you know, the day the Earth stood still, when I kind of, you know, if someone arrives from outer space, it's basically like now, it's sort of like you're getting too aggressive and the universe says, if you don't shape up, we're going to terminate you. My mate Gort, the robot here, is going to terminate you. Get it right. Well, that works for me right now. You know, we could do with someone coming down, you know, landing and saying to Donald Trump, you know, you don't stop it. My mate Gort, the robot, is going to just eradicate you. It's that simple. Sort it out. And so it's all, you know, on that metaphor level, it works. It works beautifully, I think. And I think in the documentary, something I hadn't noticed actually first time around when we did it. I don't think we included it. When, you know, him saying, well, if that end was a con, or then the whole thing was, because, you know, you have to buy into it. You know, it was always going to be that way, I think. It's just that we weren't used to it. Now, if you've got David Lynch saying there's a good Cooper and a bad Cooper, and oh, by the way, there's another one now, and that we can work with that. In those days, the fact that number six was number, it was the same guy, it was the same person, just two parts of the same person, seemed to be completely unacceptable. Obviously, it seemed unacceptable to people. You know, we can't, what's that? He can't be both things. Where are we now? And, but now that thing doesn't, you know, that seems to be quite commonplace now, that you would accept that, you know, Lynch will make it literally a split, you know, two entities rather than the good and bad within your own head. You know? But we're used to all that stuff now. I mean, good and bad. You know, it's all like, I mean, if you ever saw Tin Star, it was quite good. Tim Roth, it's another Netflix thing. Now we have to accept that most people are, he's a cop, but really he's awful as well. So we have to accept that people are very bad and very good. They can be both. It doesn't matter about their job. They are both, actually. Sometimes they behave worse than the criminals. Sometimes they live by the law. But we accept it's not that they are, everyone's kind of both these things, which is sort of the same thing, really, except in more traditional stuff, it's just one actor and one character. And in more radical stuff, it's different entities. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of the same thing.
Do you think the prisoner actually provided some of that template for how we do television.
Oh, yeah, totally. But it's, as I say, I don't know why it took so long.
Yeah.
Maybe because it was seen so unique, and maybe because you needed some really, you know, some real visionary entrepreneur like Lou Grade. I don't know. Mm. See, Lou's big mistake, as far as I'm concerned, not anything to do with Lee, is that he made that mistake. He started making movies. If you do something really well, like telly, like Patrick, you know, don't bother with the movies. And actually, every movie made was so bad. I mean, it got worse and worse. Have you seen any of them? They were truly awful, apart from Saturn V, was it? Well, apart from one, which is about how the moon landing was faked. They were all awful. He just left it alone. You know, telly, it's all right to do really good telly. You don't have to be a snob about it. You don't have to do movies. So you'd need someone of his that who take those kind of risks to get anywhere. And whether that's an organisation like Showtime or, you know, ABC, whoever it might be. But, they, you know, it's like Mulholland Drive. If you don't, you know, you will in the end end up with some goon who says, you know, who wants to look at your rushes and falls asleep. You know, no one was ever supposed to look at rushes apart from poor people who have shot it, have to wade through it because you're just panning for gold. You know, you're looking for that, you know, you're looking for that tiny bit. The executives don't know that, so they just look at load of rubbish and say, well, we're cancelling that because it's so boring. So mostly it doesn't work in your favour, but without those people, I've always been a big propagandist for the studio system, Hollywood studio system, and, you know, good producers and good organisations. I mean, you know, I did a film about Paramount Pictures, and what was great about them is you say, well, there's Billy Wilder over there. We'll leave him alone because we know Billy will do a great film. Leave him alone. Let's look at this guy over here who doesn't seem to know what he's doing. Well, we know over there Von Sternberg and Dietrich and Charlie Lang on camera. We don't have to worry about them. Let's leave them alone. And the money just keeps coming. You do a movie, it's three movies a year, and they're all more or less the same, but they're all really good, and you get left alone. We need more of that, actually. In British television, it's really bad now, obviously. You can see the results, but more people like Grey who are like Grey, he did Sunday Night London Palladium, and he did all that stuff, but he also gave Sir Kenneth Clarke his first break in television, his very first break. So he like Patrick says in the film, he didn't have limited vision. So that's where it starts. We need people like that. Otherwise, no one can do anything. And I don't see much evidence of it. So, you know, if Showtime want to pick up Twin Peaks, it's good for them. And if, you know, but I can't see any evidence of it here at all. And it's funny now, you know, if you can tell, you pick up the Guardian guide, if that's what you buy. And all the picks of the week are Netflix, Amazon. They're not bothering hardly with terrestrial television. I mean, it's just different now.
I remember it's probably about 10 years ago now when Life on Mars started.
Yeah.
And the makers talking at length about how difficult they had found it to get anyone to even entertain the notion of it.
Yeah.
Because it was a bit strange.
Yeah.
And yet, you look at it now and you think, well, it's not that strange.
No, it's certainly
strange,
isn't
nothing
it?
Unusual.
No.
But that wouldn't be out of place now on Netflix or Amazon.
No, Prime, I mean, I don't get it. I mean, I don't want to bash on, because I can bash on endlessly. But, you know, when you get something really good, and it was really good, like Ripper Street, and the writing is beautiful and the ideas are fantastic, it's really clever and compulsive. So the BBC then say, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. And it gets picked up by Amazon. You know, they do all the R&D. They, you know, as a license payoff, I'm supposed to be outraged. That outrages me. Why do you do all the work, set it all up, and then go, oh, no, not enough people are watching it. Let's just give it to them. Show it second run after. Give it to Amazon Prime. You know, I mean, I didn't understand. I signed a petition to keep that going before Amazon Prime picked it up. Shocking, actually. Shocking. I don't really know what's happening in TV anymore that can happen.
It's actually becoming very hard to find where good television is.
Yeah. I mean, anything that exists. I used to do a lot of, you know, documentaries for what was Friday night on BBC4. You could rely on it. Some really good music documentaries, many of which I made, I have to say. But, you know, even that's, everything goes. Mm. And it's because actually I think, you know, unlike Lou Grade, most of these people now are kind of just absolute proof that shit floats. These terrible mediocrities who are confused. They go, oh my God, people are watching things on their phones. Oh, what are we going to do? What are young people looking? What are young people doing? They just, and every time they make a decision, it's all wrong when they jump. They're confused because of all the platforms and all the, it's not about sitting round on Sunday night at 7:25 and watching The Prisoner. It's not like that. It's not like 17 million people that Sunday, February 2nd, whatever it was, sitting down and having that group experience, you know. It's just different. It's not worse, but it's just different. Mm. And they don't seem to be, what to do with that information. Mm. You'd think it would be liberating, wouldn't it? Every time something comes on and you think it's liberating, nothing happens. It's like when the kind of digital cameras started and everyone could be a cameraman and everyone could make a movie for tuppence. And Miramax, are you allowed to say them anymore? Yeah, Miramax said, oh, well, we'll have a cheap movie budget, you know. Did anything good come of it? Nothing. I thought there's going to be a revolution. Now there's going to be all these fantastic movies. You know, people not with no pressure, the studios breathing down, big budgets. Didn't happen. I don't know why that didn't happen. And now, you know, Soderbergh's shooting a movie on his phone. And, you know, it's probably going to be the same. There won't be any good phone movies. I don't know why.
The thing is, I've heard that before. Because when that story broke a couple of weeks ago, didn't it?
I think so.
But I'm pretty certain that the same thing may have happened about 3 or 4 years ago.
Really? It's not the first one. I mean, there have been phone movies, apparently. I don't know what they are.
It gets spoken about and suddenly everyone gets very excited. But actually, in the execution, things become very safe again. And they kind of dissipate.
You think, I could do anything now. Yeah. I've got a phone. I just have to find some people. Everyone knows some people, don't they?
Also, you do occasionally get directors who will make an incredible micro-budget film that becomes successful, and then they almost immediately get sucked into some giant Hollywood franchise machine.
I know.
And that's it. Like
That's unfortunate.
Like Gareth Edwards.
Yeah.
I made Monsters, which hardly cost any money at all.
And then Godzilla, which is god-awful. Yeah. I know.
And then the Star Wars films. I know. Yeah. It's
true, actually. There isn't the middle ground. That's very American, that, where you be like Dennis Hopper and do Easy Rider in 69, or you could be Soderbergh doing Sex, Lies and Videotape 20 years later, exactly, where you do something for nothing and then they give you millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's not like, well, now you've earned the right to do a $3 million movie.
Yeah.
So I don't know why that is. It doesn't work, obviously, as a kind of a strategy. I mean, when I used to run independent cinemas and distribution, this guy called Henry Jaglom, who was actually one of the editors of Easy Rider, one of five, and he became a director. And he never wanted to make a movie over $1 million, ever. And so he said, if you could give me 30 million, and I'll make you 30 movies. That's what I'll do. But then Ray Stark, head of Ray Stark, unashamedly, to his credit, actually said, how can I embezzle $1 million from a movie that only costs $1 million? And that's the answer.
Yeah.
What do I get out of it? How can I? What am I creaming? There's nothing to cream. Forget it. So it's all that kind of nonsense. I mean, actually, if you look at any of those industries, it's a miracle that anything good ever gets made. It's that simple. It's an absolute miracle, considering the kind of all this nonsense. It's a miracle. But actually, Hollywood, despite it being one of the most kind of business-based systems of production ever, turn them out quite regularly. I suspect because it is so industrial.
How has the process of making documentaries have changed since you did that very first 6 into 1 with...
Well, I didn't, I learned a lot from Patrick about how to interview. That's half of it if you're doing what I do. And so he really helped me with that. Unfortunately, I had lots of good contacts, so it became very, I got to know Dennis Hopper really well because I distributed his second film that was after Easy Rider that was buried by Universal in Granite. So I knew people, so I just started thinking, okay, so I wrote a treatment for a film about Dennis Hopper and took that to Channel 4 and they said, yes, we'll do that, and so we did. And I knew David Cronenberg, and I said, I want to do a film about Cronenberg. And they said, okay, let's do that. What, isn't that a lager? Oh, it doesn't matter, have some money. So it was very easy because I could deliver the talent. That's all. The first time they said no, I couldn't believe it. I just sort of was like, what? You don't want to make that? And actually, that's been the trend now. So what's changed is it was easy to get something unusual off the ground, and it's absolutely is not anymore. I mean, we've gone full circle. So all the things that Channel 4 tried to do, they themselves have been part and parcel of reneging on all of it. So you now have to have a presenter who's always on a journey. I want to find out, you know, dot, dot, dot. you've got to have a presenter. It's got to, you've got to have a voiceover. Or you've got to, you can't, we never use voiceover. That was, we thought we'd been defeated if we do that. So I've learnt doing it and in the process, but unfortunately my tastes haven't changed. So the kinds of things that I like don't really, it's quite difficult to get made now. I mean, I think it's that's just a, you don't ask for that. That's your curse, you know. I mean, I think I've always been attracted to difficult people like Patrick, like Dennis Hopper, who's really mad. although, you know, not necessarily Lynch, but a lot of the people, Donald Cameron did that movie Performance, it was a film about him. Those kind of people who themselves are attracted to difficult material, mm-hmm. and you're attracted to them. And often the people who make the kind of material you like, which is a bit difficult, aren't themselves difficult. It's sort of obvious, really. And I sort of like them. but they themselves can't get jobs. Dennis Hopper couldn't get in. You know, at one point he said, "I just want to make more movies." Yeah, well, you know, it's not going to happen. They wouldn't take a risk. Even when he went to AA and NA and he cleaned himself up, he wouldn't even smoke a cigarette in the end. It was too late because they could see the madness in his eyes. I mean, he was no fool. He couldn't fool anyone. He was mad. But it's fantastic actor and a brilliant director and a great writer, actually. So those people, unfortunately, have been people I've been attracted to. And I think that's, you know, I think when I first saw Performance when I was at art school, I was so fucked up by it. I didn't know what I'd seen. I knew something extraordinary, but I didn't know how it was working or what had happened. I think the natural reaction is to say, well, I want to find out about that. Well, how does that work and why did that do that? So I will have to find out. Sort of like the prisoner, you think, well, why is that? I have to find out why it got past all my defences and why does that say, why does it mean anything to me? So, and unfortunately, it's been those kinds of things made by those kinds of people. Why does that affect me so much? Why did, you know? And I have to meet, one way of finding out is meeting the people who made it or had something to do with it. And you'll get some sense of it, of why it was like it. It was. I mean, when I was a painter, which I thought I would be always, there was an artist called Roger Hilton. There's a whole bunch of painters down in Cornwall. And I was at art school and they said, we're going to take you, you know, we're going to Cornwall and we're going to meet all these artists, except this one, you know, who's a real problem and he's a nutbag and he's a, you know, we're not going to talk about him. And I met him by accident in a pub. And I didn't even know who he was, and it slowly dawned on me, you're that guy we're not going to be visiting and we can't talk about. And I ended up sort of looking after him for a bit. He was a serious, he's so mad, Roger. And and that's been a pattern. He was very objectionable, horrible man. Oh, brilliant artist, but and I was I was the guy at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's a tiny little village called Batalic where they shoot Poldark thing. He lived right there, and I'd be the one at 6 o'clock in the morning throwing stones out the window of the pub to get him another bottle of whiskey. I thought that was fun, and it's just been a pattern. I mean, Donald Cammell, who wrote and co-directed Performance, was I loved Donald. He ended up, you know, shooting himself in the head in 62. I mean, he sort of tree-panned himself. He did it so skillfully. He lived for 40 minutes, so he could experience crossing over from life into death. And he was that kind of guy. I mean, I was upset. I wish he'd say to him, just make more movies. You know, as a consumer, I just want to see more. But he had a big neon sign above his head, you know, beware artists at work. So, you know, he never really got the backing. And although Lynch is mad like that, it's a similar kind of thing. It's difficult to deal with people like that. Singular Vision doesn't even begin to describe what it is that they don't like. And British television now, anyway, directors don't have any say now. I was lucky enough to be at a time when we did. Now I see jobs advertised. You've got to be a shooting. You've got to do the camera work and direct somehow. And interview somewhere. And and then you generate the material, and then that's the end of your contract. They have things called edit producers now, so you don't even get to edit your own material. Someone else comes along and edits it because it's cheaper, and they don't know the material, but no one seems to care. So that doesn't work for me. That just doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. So if we ever get to the question, what you're going to do next, I have no idea, because I think something like the prison documentary was a rare thing, and that was extremely lucky that even happened. They just left me alone. But what else were they going to do anyway? But they just left me alone. You don't get left alone anymore. So if I ever get another job, it'd be interesting to see what happens. Unless you can get someone who say, I mean, before I did the film with Tom Jones, and because it was Tom, lovely Tom, we sort of got left alone because they weren't going to mess with him. Mm. And we got on really well, but that doesn't often happen. They just weren't going to mess with him. That's the end of that. What was the question? I can't remember.
Have you thought at all about what Patrick McGoohan would make of In My Mind?
Oh, I think he'd hate it. I mean, I'm pretty sure I could sit down with him. I'd love to sit down with him, actually. And show it to him. I think he wouldn't hate it. I don't know. He'd probably storm out. He'd probably say, what are you thinking? You know, it wasn't like that. I wouldn't expect him to like it. And I don't see how he could. He wouldn't hate it as much as his original one. I mean, hopefully he'd realise it was trying to make amends. But I think, I don't know, actually. I'd be so great if he could have seen it and he'd liked it. But I think that's just delusional. I don't think you can do it. I mean, I think he said somewhere, you know, all the interviews he gave, he only ever thought one was accurate, which was someone from the Manchester Guardian who had interviewed him but hadn't recorded it. Hadn't even recorded it. And he said it was the most accurate. He'd just written on a notepad. Mm. And we've only got his word for that. There was only one where he wasn't misrepresented. Mm. And that was from a guy who didn't record it and wrote it down. That seems highly unlikely to me. But it betrays a kind of, you know, attitude, I think. But that's... Did you go to the NFT?
No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't know whether to... What says the most to me about him... It was nothing to do with the film, and I didn't even tell Catherine this, but we were driving along. We were driving on Santa Monica, and because it was my first time in America, I was a real, you know. And on the other side of the road, was a big soft top like Cadillac car, and Lee Marvin was driving it, right? And, you know, he told me, and I went, "Oh my God, Lee Marvin! Look!" Ooh. Like a real terrible starfucker. And Patrick just freaked. He pulled in, dangerously, I guess. Just pulled in, stopped the car, got out of the car, slammed the door. And I didn't know, so I just followed him. I followed him. He's at the bar. He's not drinking then, I don't think. And I came, I thought, God, what? And he just said, "That man's got a glass jaw." And I said, "Oh, what?" He said, we were at this party once with Lee Marvin was there, and he came up to Joan, and do you know what he said to Joan? And I said, "Oh no, what?" He said to Joan, "How would you like a good..." He couldn't even say the word fuck, he had to mouth it, you know. "How would you like a good..." And apparently he'd hit him and broken his jaw. He said, "I found out what hospital he was in next day, and I went to the hospital and I said, 'Mr. Marvin, when you get out of here, I'm going to kill you. And the only way I won't kill you is if you send a dozen red roses to Joan for every word you said. How would you like a good fuck? Let's say I make that 7 dozen roses.'" And his veins, you know, he's like, "Oh," I guess it's incandescent. And apparently Marvin did send Joan 7 dozen roses and he didn't kill him. But that kind of intensity of kind of... I thought, God, this is who I'm dealing with, actually. It's someone who, you know... And then I remember the first question he asked me was basically, you know, "When you get married, don't you think it's important to be a virgin?" And I thought, "I don't even know you." That's a bit... heavy for the first question. I didn't, you know, I'd fallen at the first hurdle, really, but I didn't let on. So someone who was fiercely, monogamous and fiercely principled, but who was a good-looking, highly paid actor, must have come across so much in his path to Ben, to take him off that path. And I don't know if he ever did it or didn't, but I should imagine it was a constant torment. So all that stuff about not kissing women, all that stuff's absolutely true. I know he says in the film, I'm not a prude, but he's not being prudish. It's just, you know, there was so, he was so tortured about all that stuff. Imagine the temptations, and you're being in the film and television industry, the highest paid, good looking actor. What the hell? But believing that all that is sinful, it's sin. It's absolute sin. And I think that's it for me. They didn't find all the missing interviews. They did a little interview with him on the beach, which they couldn't. The Russians never turned up of that. I don't know what happened to it. But he actually confessed to having been, beaten quite badly at school on a regular basis around the Catholic school. And so it's all that kind of horrible, difficult childhood. Who doesn't have a difficult childhood? But, a certain kind of difficult childhood. And I think he was dedicated to Joan, but I think it must have been quite difficult for him. And I'm glad he broke Lee Marvin's jaw. I mean, Lee Marvin was a Marine, wasn't he? I like that story. I'm glad he did that. I think he was an arse, wasn't he? Mm. But you wouldn't want to take him on necessarily. But he did. And I don't think he made that stuff up. Just that it was such an immediate reaction. He was actually veering off the road just because I'd spotted him. So it was like, constantly your innocence getting, you bump into stuff. You think, oh, it's Lee Marvin. Everyone's like Lee Marvin, don't they? And he's a Hollywood actor, great. But no, it was a bit like that all the time. Just blundering into a minefield. Like, oh, God. Not doing enough research, not doing enough research. Of course, you'd know now, wouldn't you? Nisa, you could just do all that reading and checking up about people. And you wouldn't be quite so unprepared. It's quite hard to find stuff to read in those days. Actually, Six of One was going. They'd done a lot of legwork in terms of basic stuff, schedules, scripts, shooting day, but not much beyond that. Not much interpretive stuff. It was stuff for fans.
Yeah. And certainly, I suppose it's from an era. Now when TV shows are on, they're being analysed from the time they're announced. Every minute they're on, every episode gets analysed.
I know, it's amazing now. I know, really.
And certainly, I think it would be interesting to know. I mean, if The Prisoner was on for the first time now, I think it would be picked apart in the most.
I know. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? All the kind of inconsistencies and all the. It's funny, I don't say even I, because I haven't seen it that many times, but when it's on, you're avid and you're looking at it and you see stuff that they could do because they knew there were no video records. It was a one-off. There are lots of shots where smoke is going into chimneys that involve Rover because it's got a reverse mag on it, on the camera. There's lots of... you think, God, that's so sloppy. But only because we can do that now. Yeah. And that was like 7:25 on Sunday night where I was in London. That was it. That was it. And then it was kind of nothing but, I guess, what you'd now call water cooler moments after that. Everyone just talking about it. What was that? What happened? How could that be? I was just talking to myself because no one talked to me. Anyway, that was it.
Do you remember the first time you saw it in colour? How different it was?
Yeah, that was. I think that was when, actually going to making the documentary. And it hadn't started yet. We were up against it. And being given this print from ITC and taking it to a Telecine place in Covent Garden and him putting it up and coming up on the monitors. And then I thought the colour was amazing enough, but then he could make it even better or maybe closer to how it really was. So it was, I think I thought I'd seen it in colour. I think most people did think they'd seen it in colour. So that was really spectacular. I don't know... We really didn't see it. It's funny. We really didn't. And now, now when you get, you're making the film and you're getting these high debt, HD masters, tape masters, meticulously kind of restored, virtually frame by frame. You cannot believe it. Even now I'm looking at it, even thinking, Jesus. Think of what the kind of television sets we were looking at them on, the kind of reception we were getting. But this unbelievable stuff. I'm not sure if it ever really looked like that, actually. I don't know. I don't know about processes anymore. Mm. I mean, I only buy Blu-rays now, but, you know, I look at some kind of Hitchcock films and think, did it ever really look like that? Mm. Did North by Northwest ever look that glorious? Mm. Ever? It might have done. Or maybe it was never meant to look like that. I don't know. I just love it. It's gorgeous in Cary Grant. Mm. Sleek and sharp and perfect. I mean, he should be like that, right? He was like that, I'm sure. He was always like that.
Is it like the reverse of going to a gallery and seeing a painting that has faded and thinking, well, that looked different when it was made, but this is what I'm seeing now?
Yeah, I know. I remember being taken to see a huge Van Gogh show must have been on the South Bank, 1969. And the sunflowers, and being told that, of course, you know, the shitty paint that he used or whatever, for whatever reason, they're brown now and they would have been glorious yellow. Mm. So it was always a thing about having to understand, you know, what it looked like. And it's a weird thing, because there was a guy who, I think it's a oft-faked artist, Vermeer. When you try and fake something, you know, it's quite difficult. Not even for those reasons. You can get the right kind of paints and all that. But it's really what it looks like in the, you know, in 2018. Sort of, you know, because things change because of the year you're in. You know, so I think you can. A lot of fakes, I think, maybe discover because of that thing about how where we are now looking at something, rather than anything that's particularly wrong with the technique or the kind of paint. It's a complicated business, actually. I mean, I've filmed a faker, and it's scary, you know, how they can just do it. But you just go, you know, and there it is. And actually, I don't know if it really matters. You don't buy it because it's Matisse. Well, you might if you're a dealer, but you buy it because of that vision, that way it looks. If I could own one, I didn't care if it was him or not, frankly. I'd love some of those things. Mm. If it's been done by Imre Dahori, and you know, I don't care. If he can do it, that's amazing, I think. I'd just love to own some. I don't care what it's right. I did a film about Warhol, you know, Warhol, one of the films I did about Warhol, the Art Authentication Board, Andy Warhol, Art Authentication Board, who control the market and don't authenticate things because it's not in their interest, and do authenticate things. You know, it was a film about a particular painting. I think it was a genuine Warhol. I'm no doubt. They say it isn't. But it's beautiful anyway. So it's just the guy who owns it is annoyed, because he thought it was worth maybe $3 million, and they're saying it's not worth anything. So there goes his pension. To me, it doesn't matter, although I think it probably was. But it's still a lovely thing. And it's a screen print anyway. But, you know, in terms of copying, just think it is funny about, you know, David Lynch has been responsible for more awful films than almost any other director, because there's so much stuff there you can just copy. And if you have no talent, even his own daughter did that. I mean, you know, sorry, it doesn't work. If the right stuff doesn't underpin it, you know, it doesn't work. It just looks awful. It's like he must have been responsible for more awful student films than any director ever. Mm. Let's get a dwarf. That'll be weird. I mean, I don't, you know, whatever. Just not really underpinned by anything. Mm. No intelligence, or a different intelligence.
So, Chris, we'd like to thank you for joining us today to talk about your interest in The Prisoner and your wonderful new documentary, In My Mind.
Pleasure.
That was released late last year. It's available on DVD, Blu-ray, and we strongly recommend that everyone goes and checks it out. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
So we'd like to thank Chris again for joining us. It was really great to talk to him. He was so generous with his time. We had a really fun time talking about The Prisoner, about Lynch, about Chris's own documentary filmmaking career, and what the TV landscape has been like over the last 30 years.
And as we said right at the start of the episode, this is the first of a two-part chat with Chris. The second part is more focused on Chris's other shared interest with us, which is the world of film director David Lynch, and focusing on the recent return of Twin Peaks,
as well. And again, there are some really interesting parallels between The Prisoner, Twin Peaks, Patrick McGowan, David Lynch. So the conversation does kind of cover both topics a lot. But that episode, which is part of our Time for Cherry Pie and Coffee stream, which focuses more on David Lynch and Twin Peaks, will be out in a few days.
And because it's very much a continuation of the chat, we do occasionally pick back up on the subject of The Prisoner and Patrick McGowan in that episode as well. So we do hope that you'll have fun listening to that one.
So for now, we'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of The Tally Ho. Please feel free to get in touch, drop us a line, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or find us through our website as well, which is all under the name of our mothership podcast, Time for Cakes and Ale.
Yeah, so on Twitter you can find us at TFCAA, and the website is timeforcakesandale.com.
But for now, signing off until the next part of the interview in Time for Cherry Pie and Coffee.
Be seeing you.